Welcome to a psychodelicious conversation on mental health issues and trends from two local mental health professionals in the greater Lansing area. I'm Michael Stratton, LMSW.
And I'm Morgan Bowen, DNP, PMHNP, and we're here to provide you with a deep dive into the human experience of consciousness and beyond. Our aim is to be educational and entertaining, so just kick back and open your ears and your minds.
Hey, I'm Mike Stratton.
And I'm Morgan Bowen.
We are back for season two of A Psychodelicious Conversation.
Back. We're
and
back.
So I've heard from people like, when are you going to produce more shows? This is it.
We're on a roll.
You mean there's nothing happening after this? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not. No, this is season two. We don't know how long. We didn't know season one was season one. We didn't even know it.
No, we didn't.
And here we are. We've been renewed.
That's a process of exploration and experience. I would like to combine those two words. Experience-aloration.
Yeah,
I just said this earlier today. Making up words is fun.
It is. You can sometimes make it into the dictionary. You know, if a word catches on, I don't know that experience alloration is gonna will catch on. It's a little bit much. It's a mouthful.
Use it in a
sentence. It's kind of like psychodelicious conversation. I'm just saying.
I would like that. Yeah, that should be in the dictionary.
This is actually a trend of yours, Morgan, I think.
Of making up words.
Making up words is good.
Well, sometimes words are not, you know, you don't have the word. You need to make it up.
And you just need more.
Yeah.
Sometimes the word needs more to explain exactly what it is.
So you're back. Did you enjoy your time off?
I worked the whole time, I think.
Okay. Way to go.
It's good. And I heard from both of our fans about what our topic should be today.
All two of them? Well,
but Morgan actually traveled.
I did. I went to Hawaii, so I did have a week of vacation, went to the Big Island with my husband and my mom, actually. So it was my family used to live in Hawaii. My father was in the military, so we were stationed in Oahu.
Like this part was, of your growing up was there?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
He grew up all over the place.
Yeah. I am so jelly.
Yeah.
So we moved here when I was 10. So I am a Michigander. Both my parents are from Michigan, so we settled here. But so we went back. Well, I was on the Big Island. We lived in Oahu when I was young. So, but it was nice. It was nice to take my mom. She's a big fan of the Big Island. Well, she's a big fan of Hawaii. But there was the tsunami warning. This was when there was the large earthquake in Russia somewhere.
Right.
And so there was a tsunami warning. They shut down the beaches. They evacuated the coast. It was actually a very, I thought it was a very good response, but nothing happened. there was no giant wave.
There is nothing wrong with preparing, though.
Right, exactly. I mean, of course, they had the wildfires in Maui, which, you know, different type of natural disaster, but that was
Lahaina. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never been to Maui and haven't. Yeah.
No, I've been to Maui three times and I've given talks there, which is good.
I'm so jelly of both of you. I have never been to Hawaii and I'd like to go.
Oh, it's worth it. It's worth going.
Yeah. It's a great place. It's definitely an amazing place.
Well, our topic today, though, is not Hawaii.
Well, that is a shame.
It is the opposite of Hawaii. It's shame. And this is by request by a couple of different people who talked to me and had ideas about things we could talk about. And so I said, okay, we'll work
this out. It's a lively, sparkling, sunshiny topic.
Well,
why do you think they wanted, what was the content? Did they say why they were interested?
I think it's a topic that touches so much of mental health that they were curious about it and curious to know more about it. And so I thought, well, let's do that. Let's do it. All right. So to start with, you know, like a definition of shame is like a bad feeling that you have about yourself, and it's different than guilt. So guilt is you feel guilty for what you do, but you feel shamed for who you are. And so that's often like a result of kind of a childhood experience in some way of feeling like I'm bad, I'm different, I'm flawed, I'm something like that. And I can resonate with that, you know, that I felt that way for a number of reasons.
Well, you're Catholic.
The Catholic bit is big. It is really big. It's yeah. So,
well, I was thinking of it in terms of, I mean, as you're talking, a social control. I mean, the idea of taboo, the idea of something that is out of bounds, that is culturally inappropriate, and then the cultural buildup around that to kind of promote that or to, you know, to highlight that. And that's not necessarily a conscious thing. I mean, you know, so I would imagine also, I come from an anthropology background. All societies have some form of taboo of this is not okay.
Well, they show that anyone who's a dog owner, a dog will experience, you can see a dog experiences shame, you know, but it's more like guilt. Maybe if it's torn up your couch and you walk in and it looks sheepish, it just looks, it knows it's done something wrong. But shame has it does have a function. I mean, there's kind of good shame and bad shame. That's a real, you know, basic kind of way to describe it. But shame does keep us from doing certain things. You know, it helps us understand what the culture is. It helps us to develop some kind of empathy about how would another person experience this. What's okay, what's not okay, what are my boundaries, all of those kinds of things. But the kind of shame I think often that our clients would experience is stuff that has to do with really a deep-seated sense of their own identity, of just like, I'm really different, I'm really flawed, I'm really not okay. And that could be conveyed in childhood, that can be conveyed in trauma. Sometimes when people experience trauma, they keep it as a secret. Secrets are connected very much to shame. I think that's an element of shame. I always say that some things grow well in the dark, and shame grows well in the dark. So does addiction. So does all kinds of different kind of pathologies, I would guess, you know, if we want to call it pathologies. Or,
well, shame connects a lot of those things. You know, there's a element, well, a big element, you know, I'm thinking of abuse, you know, that happens young, and then shame becomes a manipulative tool, you know, that the abuser or the perpetrator is able to influence, you know, and try to control the situation so that, you know, the person that is being abused doesn't say anything, or
they're being blamed for it. Yeah. You know, I wouldn't do this if it wasn't for you, or if you tell somebody this terrible thing's going to happen and you have to keep this a secret forever. So it's not uncommon. That's not an uncommon thing.
And then with addiction, maybe, or overuse or problematic use, whatever it may be, you know, substances, gambling, sex, there's a self-shame, you know, maybe not somebody saying you can't tell anybody, you're telling yourself nobody can know how much I'm using, or the, you know, the way that I'm using.
Oh, you know, we didn't identify Dedalion. We should identify.
Oh, hi. Well, the king of shame. The king of shame.
Dedalion. Dedalion is our producer. He's the third voice you hear.
I just figured I was being shamed.
You just raised your hand. Dedalion is different. And he's blushing. Yeah. Well, people do things to deal with their shame, and sometimes that feeds the shame.
Yeah.
So it could be the source of addictions. It can be the source of eating disorders. It can be the source of becoming a klepto, you know, of stealing things. It could be a source of sexually acting out. It can be the source of all kinds of different things to help, like, to master the shame. Mm-hmm. Like, I will, but then it feeds it, you know. So it's a difficult cycle. Or there's a local guy, Gersh Kaufman. Are you familiar with Gersh Kaufman?
I don't think so. I know some Kaufmans, but not that one.
Yeah, I knew him. He's a psychotherapist in this community. I think he's retired. I'm not positive. He is the partner of Lev Raphael, who actually used to have a show at LCC.
He did.
Many years ago, he would interview authors because Lev is an author. Anyway, they're partners. And Gersh wrote a book about shame. And he identified the idea of a shame spiral. Spiral is what he called it. Yeah, a shame spiral, where you go down that rabbit hole of it and you keep doing things that make you feel more ashamed. It's hard to get out of it.
That's a term I regularly hear from clients. Mm-hmm. They go, you know, I went into a shame spiral.
He invented the term.
Oh, interesting.
Talk about people inventing words or terms.
Just an entire term, yeah.
You know, something, it starts, you know, what they describe is, you know, something like oftentimes a well-worn trigger for them. You know, I'm not good enough, or you know, I work with a lot of trans clients, so an element of gender dysphoria, and then it kind of expands from there. There's like a central messaging, usually related to I'm not good enough, you know, people don't like me, I'm not worthy. And then it just kind of brings in everything, you know, like I didn't do this when I was six and I should have done this and maybe I shouldn't be doing what I'm doing. And everything becomes a potential area of just negativity.
Yeah.
And it's terrible. It's awful.
I was thinking about this because I knew we were going to be talking about it. And I was thinking about, as an adult, I had these series of dreams that were really shame-based dreams. And the dreams were, no matter where I was or what I was doing, if it was a new job, the boss would approach me and say, you know we gave you this job, but we found out about you, so we're going to have to fire you. Or I know we admitted you into this program at school, but we've discovered this. And there was never any identification of what that was that they discovered. And it was a recurring dream. And so that sense of like, I'm different, I'm flawed. And so I was like reviewing in my head, like what sort of things happen? Now, these are minor things. This wouldn't have caused the whole thing. But for instance, I grew up in an alcoholic family, you know, so there wasn't a lot of attention placed on, let's help Mike master things. Like, let's teach him to tie his shoes. I was the only kid in the class who couldn't tie my shoes. I was probably really late in learning how to ride a bike. I didn't ride a bike until I was 13 years old. Those kinds of things, you know, I broke my arm really severely when I was 8 years old, so I didn't participate in sports. I'm different than the other kids, you know. So all of those things.
God, you're a mess.
Tell me about it. What do I do for a living, man? What?
Yeah, answers a lot of questions.
But Morgan is shaming me.
Get it together.
Snap out of it. But a part of the solution has been to be really free with my self-disclosure, to own that. We're going to talk about that in the second part of the show.
Yeah. And to understand, you know, to demystify it, to, you know, take it away from being the idea that there's something inherently wrong with me, that I am not a kid who can tie his shoes, that there's a reason why that happened, and that there's a bigger picture here that isn't your fault.
Right.
Not your fault.
And I was so happy when I was able to tie my shoes finally.
I bet.
And I was so happy when I taught myself to ride a bike. And I was so happy when, you know, I started to do any kind of sports, do long distance running, which is kind of one of the things that I started doing. But those ways of displaying some kind of mastery were like really crucial. But there's all kinds of different, I was writing a list of different kinds of shaming. So there's
ways to shame somebody?
Toxic shame. There's slut shaming. There's online shaming. There's social media shaming. Kink shaming, identity shaming, there's internalized shame, there's food shaming, there's fat shaming, there's what else?
I find it amazing that as technology grows, we have greater definitions and ways to shame people.
Yeah. And people experience that.
Yeah.
Teens are very, very vulnerable to being, you know, being told by their friends or even by this audience of like, you're different, or you're, look at you, you've got this, you've got that, you know, you're different than us, you're flawed in some way. And then they're crushed by it, and it can lead kids to suicide. You know, it's just so devastating, so toxic. Age shaming.
You're looking intently at me.
Well, this is a part of our history. It was funny because Morgan
in season
would,
one.
In season one, this was a subplot that Morgan would refer to my age every now and then. And then we talked about it outside of it. And I said, you know, that really bothers me. My glasses are steaming as I talk about this. It's got some heat. It's just got some heat. It's hard for me to talk about that. And then you stopped. Mm-hmm. You stopped, which is another good thing, you know, like, oh, my gosh. And I've known friends who are, you know, they're for instance, interested in, like they do Weight Watchers or something like that, and they're very conscientious. If you mention anything about food, they'd say, will you please not mention anything about food when we're together? And I'm like, oh, cool, yeah, all right, I didn't even realize. You know, that
that's interesting. You know, I was thinking while you were saying that, because I did do that, and I have, you know, a bit of an ageist thing, and there's many reasons. I'm not ageist in and of itself. There's, you know, some background there. It's really about my parents. But, you know, in my family, humor was extensive, and that was a way that a lot of people dealt with things, bad things, good things. But it was, you know, sarcasm and delivering something in a way that was communicated some level of like, this is, you know, you should not be doing this, you're making fun of flaws, was definitely a way to communicate kind of what was okay and what was not okay. And humor can do that, you know, there can be a bite to it, and it can, you know, it can really trigger for people like on the receiving end that shameful, you know, that kind of the message of shame that, you know, we have when we're like, ooh, like, yeah, you know, does my breath stink? Or just like, you know, like, these insecurities, these fears, these, you know, that discomfort.
Well, that's one of the manifestations of shame, I think, is that people can develop kind of almost an OCD, mm-hmm, like, uh-oh, do I smell? Do mm-hmm I smell bad? Mm-hmm. And a need to, either a fear of checking with people, like, do I smell bad? Or am I really different in some way or another? I've worked with different clients, I'm sure you have, mm-hmm, too, who have, mm-hmm, some kind of obsessive worry, like, mm-hmm, I'm worried that, you know, fill in the blank, I'm going to do this very bad thing. And I always help them distinguish, you know, there's a difference between the thought and the action of it. But that's usually shame-based, that idea, mm-hmm, of like, I'm just even having the thought. This is a shameful thing that I'm even having the thought, and that means I'm a bad person in some way, versus, no, if you're not doing the action, you're not.
Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. The fear of it. You know, do you think shame is a universal condition, a human condition, a part of human nature, if we can speak to something like that? I mean, it just seems so, I mean, it is. It's just cross-cultural. It's across, you know, historic periods. There's
the idea
the
that
the first human was ashamed of something.
Well, Adam
I'm not hairy right? enough. Yep. I'm not bipedal enough. I'm like still in all fours, and he's bipedal.
Exactly. Well, they say that they see evidence of shame in chimpanzees, for instance. Mm-hmm. So it is something that's like inbred in a sense in us. Although a lot of what we're talking about is it getting kind of fed into us by traumatic experiences or kind of a toxic environment that you grow up in.
But there's a template that is built upon.
And I think that's part of a conscience, mm-hmm, you know, but it's...
There's something evolutionarily positive about shame.
Yeah. Again, you know, it helps us to know I shouldn't do that because mm-hmm that would be wrong. It helps us, another person would experience this in a negative way if I did this or said this or behaved this way towards them. It helps us to establish boundaries too. So, I mean, all those things are useful. And the idea of being able to have this self-reflection of like, I mean, who doesn't have a bunch of things? We're not going to talk about them in the year, I promise. But who doesn't have a pocket full of experiences of like, I hope no one finds this out about mm-hmm me? I think all of us do have something in our history where we just say, oh, I'm not proud of that. That is not how I want to be seen. Mm-hmm. You know, no. And I say that to clients, not all the time, but inevitably people start telling you their deepest, darkest secrets. And I often say, nobody wants to be judged on their worst day. You know, mm-hmm, nobody wants to be judged on their worst decision. And we all have some. And the difference is, you know, I did this horrible thing and I feel good about it, or I did this horrible thing, I mm-hmm feel terrible about it. I feel shame.
Well,
about
the
it.
Lack of shame is, you know, is problematic. I mean, if yeah there's not shame, if there's, you know, sociopathy or psychopathy, then that is a, that leads to some, or has the potential of leading to some problematic things.
Our dear leader, who will go unnamed, he may feel bad about what he did, but he feels bad about the consequences of getting caught for it, not for the action itself. He has no empathy for the victims of what he did. So, again, these are my opinions only, not a reflection of the
institution,
of the institution, or of anyone else sitting at this table.
Well, I think we would be remiss if we did not talk about sexuality, nudity, and, you know, the more primal desires and its association with shame.
Oh, do go on.
Well, you know, as a gay man, you know, there is a whole lot of shame built into, you know, coming from that, you know, coming through that. And I would say, you know, I'm not. I'm thinking about generations that are happening now. I mean, still, I talk to a lot of young folks, both, you know, professionally and otherwise. And this sense that, I mean, there's just a very communicated cultural sense that you are wrong or that you're sinful or built incorrectly. Something fundamental that you really don't have the ability to change is problematic. And you get that message very young. And it's kind of built into, I would say, whether or not somebody is very comfortable or free in their sexuality as a queer person, there's at least an understanding of, you know, the opposite of that. And but sexuality in general, you know, it doesn't have to be queer sexuality. I mean, it can be.
Well, you mentioned Catholicism.
Sex outside of marriage.
I felt a lot of shame around that stuff.
Yeah.
Just being Catholic and knowing like this is a sin. You know, this is wrong. This is there's only one way to have sex, and that's to reproduce. And you do it with a wife, and there's no other kind of sex that gets acknowledged, and you have to confess if you have any other experience. So,
and I think it's well traveled or well known that American, we have a very puritanical kind of background, and other, you know, European or other places thinking that we are fairly stuffy. And when it comes to sexuality, just very, but the other thing I was thinking about is that, you know, there's a whole, and this is not my area of expertise, but there's a whole realm of psychiatry dealing with sexual, like fetishism and different.
Deviance.
Yes. What is it? There's a term for it. And I, you know, parasexual something, something. I'm trying to remember what the.
You can make your own term.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I guess there's an idea, and this is, you know, pretty Freudian, that, you know, things that happen in childhood or things that happen in developmental stages can become, you know, that are shame-based can then become part of a sexual kind of inner fantasy world. And I used to have a friend in New York whose sister was a dominatrix, and she said that her client base was pretty consistently a very religious or well, you know, judges, lawyers, like, you know, it was a
high functioning,
authoritarian, come from restricted, you know, kind of repressed backgrounds that sought services from, you know, sex workers or whatever.
Yeah. An enactment. Well, there's a lot in what you just said.
Yeah.
The idea in childhood, kids don't do a good job of identifying or differentiating between the feelings they have and the sense of their self. So they merge those things, and they just feel like, okay, I feel bad, therefore I am bad. You know, I've been corrected in this way. And I'm not going to go into detail.
This is going to be
unusual where I'm going to actually have a boundary.
But I learned
some stuff happened to me at a pre-verbal level where I internalized a lot of that kind of stuff. And it came from other people. And so I think that idea of like, I'm wrong in some way translated to me or somehow
imprinted
in a way. Yeah.
Well, and I'm just thinking now too, like, you know, when, as a therapist and as a, you know, mental health professional, I mean, our role is kind of to try to explore and put, you know, kind of shine a light or expose shame, whereas maybe in more of a fetish type of way. And, you know, this is not kink shaming, that the expression or the part is, I don't know if joyful is the right word, but there's something intoxicating, valuable to the person about experiencing the shame in a way. It's not necessarily.
It's mastery. I think it is getting mastery over something that was maybe
being mastered.
One point being
depends on your kink.
This is why you guys can't take too much time off. Just saying.
Come on. I mean, you know, I am.
What? All right, there's part two. A psychodelicious conversation is meant for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is no substitute for therapy and should not be treated as such. If you feel a need for real therapy, you should consult your local provider, Google therapy or therapists in your area, check with community mental health, or a suicide hotline if you are feeling suicidal.
Mike and Morgan welcome your questions, feedback, or dilemmas. Feel free to send us an email at apsychodeliciousconversation@gmail.com. That is apsychodelicious, psychodeliciousconversation@gmail.com.
The views expressed on this podcast are solely the opinions of Mike Stratton and Morgan Bowen, and do not reflect the views or opinions of any site broadcasting this podcast. Replication of this podcast without written permission is strictly prohibited. Connecting you with Lansing Community College, this is LCC Connect.
LCC
Connect.
Voices,
vibes,
vision.
Lansing Community College's downtown and west campuses offer conference and event spaces that can accommodate over 500 attendees. Professional event planners are available for assistance from setup to catering, free event parking, and on-site customer service. For more information about LCC's conference and event spaces, visit lcc.edu and search conference.
Keep yourself connected with what's happening in mid-Michigan by joining us for Community Convos, a show from LCC Connect, where we talk with the people who put the festive in our festivals and those that give traction to our attractions. Find out who's on the convo and listen on demand at lccconnect.org.
As a veteran of the United States military, I can finally get the opportunity to enjoy special events, like a date with my wife, or going out together with my family and friends. Things that we couldn't afford, thanks to VetTix. Every empty seat at a concert, a game, motorsports, or a play is a missed opportunity to say thanks to a veteran and service member. We can help. We can give our veterans a special event where they, too, can create their own cherished memories. Find out how by visiting www.vettix.org. That's www.vettix.org. Find out how you can make a difference in a veteran's life.
Lansing Community College welcomes transfer students. Transfer students may apply prior credits toward their LCC degree, certificate, or transfer program. Learn more at lcc.edu/youbelong.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Welcome to B2B, Boots to Books, the show where we explore the journeys of veterans and military-connected students as they navigate their paths from service to the classroom and beyond. I'm Dustin Abrego.
And I'm Rebecca Allen, your hosts. Each week, we'll dive into powerful stories of resilience, determination, and success.
Whether you're a veteran yourself, a military family member, or simply inspired by the strength of those who serve, you're in the right place.
Let's turn the page and start this incredible journey together. All right, welcome back to B2B. I am your solo host this week, Rebecca Allen. Dustin is doing what he does best and making sure that our newest students are set up for success at orientation. So this week, I am joined by my good friend, Justin Coates.
Hello.
And we are going to be talking about a couple of topics that I love, mental health and Dungeons & Dragons, which weirdly overlap.
So like peanut butter and chocolate.
Yes.
It goes great together.
So welcome in, Justin.
Thank you for having me. I'm
very glad to have you here. How about we start out with having you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So my name is Justin Coates. I work for the Veterans Health Administration out of Ann Arbor, but I oversee a lot of different counties throughout Michigan and Ohio. My job is to be a community engagement and partnership coordinator, which basically means I look for opportunities to assist anyone in the community, whether that is, you know, like local mental health agencies. It can be universities like this one, obviously. Anywhere anyone is helping identify veterans in the community, serve veterans in the community, help them overcome social isolation, I get to kind of stick my nose in and see how I can help out. My own background, I served in the U.S. Army from 2008 to 2013. I had two combat deployments as an airborne infantryman in support of Operation Enduring Freedom. I think that was 2009. And then again, midway through 2011, got out of the military, really benefited from some excellent mental health services from the VA when I got out and I moved back to Michigan, really inspired me to become a social worker myself. I went to University of Michigan. I apologize. I'm so sorry. I went to University of Michigan, Dearborn, and then I went to the University of Southern California for their military social work track. Graduated in 2018. And started getting really involved with veteran services. Even when I was working for community mental health, I always went out of my way to find, you know, that population and see what I could do to help. I've been working with the VA since around 2021. I've been in this role where my job is specifically community engagement since midway through last year, so a little bit over a year. Prior to that, I was working for the Ann Arbor Psychosocial Rehabilitation Program. That was where I had the opportunity to really kind of lay the groundwork for what would become the Veterans Adventure League. I was originally providing therapeutically applied tabletop role-playing games. So it was basically Dungeons & Dragons group therapy, which was a lot of fun. And once I left that position, a lot of the veterans that I had worked with wanted to continue playing the game. I obviously was looking for opportunities to connect veterans, service members, and their families through RPGs. And so it kind of blossomed from there. Hopefully that's not, is that enough or is that too much?
I think that's probably good. So you mentioned the Veterans Adventure League.
Yes.
What is the Veterans Adventure League?
The Veterans Adventure League is a organization that is dedicated to bringing service members, veterans, and their families together through the love of tabletop gaming. Mm-hmm. That's the bullet point. That's it in a nutshell. That's the elevator pitch of it. It's veterans, service members, and their families coming together to play D&D, but also to get support in figuring out where to play. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've got someone that wants to play, they don't have a table to play with, hooking them up with someone who does have a table. We've got a little table development team where if you want to DM, but you're scared, you don't know how, we'll help you learn how. Mm-hmm. And we also have what's called the Sentinel team, which Rebecca, obviously you're familiar with as you are a member of our Sentinel team, where we really encourage our members to participate in suicide prevention trainings that we also offer. Mm-hmm. And we're also partnering with some local peer support groups for veterans. Really the goal is to kind of provide a space for veterans to get together and play, have a lot of fun, and also have access to resources, access to mental health support, all the things that we really as a community need to be providing to mm-hmm. each other and ourselves.
All right. So how did this all get started?
Yeah. So it's funny. Really, I mentioned how it kind of began when I was providing the actual clinical therapy. Mm-hmm. So Veterans Adventure League is not therapy, right? It really is just, and I say just, you know, quotation marks, all it is people having a great time together, right? But originally, when I was working for the psychosocial rehab program in Ann Arbor, the idea was utilizing D&D to help veterans that were experiencing PTSD, anxiety, depression, right? Mm-hmm. Bipolar disorder, all the stuff that you can really kind of practice the skills for in a role-playing setting. Mm-hmm. Anyone who's ever been a therapist knows sometimes getting people to show up for your group therapy can be a pain. No one ever missed a D&D session, right? No one ever misses a D&D group therapy session. Everyone wants to play, right? When I took this new job, which was focused not on, like, I don't do clinical work anymore, mm-hmm. right? It's all like macro level social work.
Yeah.
A couple of the veterans who had really benefited from the program and graduated from the program reached out to me and said, hey, what do we need to do to kind of bring this out to the rest of the service member, veteran, family population. I'm going to say SMVF from now on, yeah, because I hate having to, we love our acronyms here, you know, SMVF population. What do we need to get it out there? And we, you know, right off the bat, it's like, okay, well, it can't be clinical, right? Because you have to be a therapist to be able to provide it. And you have, yeah, to have notes and everything like that. But it could be a community thing where you're coming together to play. But then very rapidly from there, we thought, well, what makes that different from just, you know, going down to your hobby store and playing? Mm-hmm. Just do that, right? Well, maybe what can make it different is that this organization isn't just D&D, but with SMVF, maybe we can also kind of provide a framework for developing dungeon masters, mm-hmm, for providing mental health counseling, for providing peer support groups, right? And it's really kind of grown from there. The organization is only around a year old. And at this point, you know, we have tables set up all throughout the state of Michigan. We've got one going in Portland, Oregon. I just found out. Yeah. Every now and then someone will reach out and say, hey, yes, we are a Val table. We have been following along and doing our own thing. We would like to come to a meeting. And it's like, yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah. By all means, our lost children, come home. You know. But yeah, that's really kind of where it came from. And that's kind of where we are right now.
Okay. So you mentioned that this is part of just providing that support. So why do you feel, as a mental health professional, that camaraderie is so important for that mental health aspect?
Yeah. So obviously, and I say this as someone who, you know, I love to provide clinical therapy. I'm never going to disparage that. As much as I really think that we as veterans can certainly benefit from 12 rounds of CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, right? You know, it's good to go see a therapist. It's good to talk to someone. Very often, what we don't have is a sense of community, mm-hmm, right? A sense of community where there are people that have shared our experiences. You know, they even if they're not veterans themselves, right? Or they're veterans from a different generation, right? The table that I run on Fridays, you know, my father, who's a Persian Gulf veteran, he plays. I'm a Global War on Terror veteran. We've got another Global War on Terror veteran. We've got a guy from the Cold War era kind, mm-hmm, of thing. And then we have one of the veterans, his adult son plays with us, right? Mm-hmm. So very different generations. Mm-hmm. You know, the one guy, he's not a veteran. He's the child of a veteran, right? But at the same time, we all kind of have that shared experience. Mm-hmm. There's that sense in which, you know, we can all kind of relate to each other. We always encourage veterans to drag their spouses along with them too. one of our newest veterans, his wife also plays, and we're like, you got to get her in here. Come on. We really need a cleric. We need a cleric so bad. I heard she wants to play a cleric. Please. we really need someone to come in. So there's that sense of community, right, where you're able to be with people who kind of speak your language, mm-hmm, right? But also it's not so similar that you're almost like, you know, internalizing, where you're, yeah, like, you know, reinforcing, like you're only around people that have been exactly the same as you. There's enough diversity within our population to prevent that. Mm-hmm. And I would also say, and this is something one of our members, a gentleman named Dusty, who has been a tireless advocate for D&D ever since I've known him, he talks a lot about the need for our population, or SMVF, to have a continued mission. Mm-hmm. Right. We are at our best not only when we are kind of looking after ourselves, but when we're actively looking after each other. So the sense in which, hey, I am a member of the Veterans Adventure League, I play Val, but also next month I have a training coming up where I get to learn how to spot the signs of suicide, mm-hmm, and I get to intervene. And I'm kind of taking responsibility for my brothers and sisters in our community. And I'm going to learn, you know, the same way a good citizen might learn, you know, CPR, right? You know, you don't throw your batteries in the trash. You take them to the library. You know, you dispose of them in the right place. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to eat them. I learned that. I was surprised. I was very disappointed.
Sounds like a Marine thing to do.
That's crayons.
I mean, you got to upgrade at some point.
That's true. But yeah, this sense in which, you know, when you're a part of Val, you can say, yeah, you know, I'm not just playing a game. I'm actively being a part of my community. I am going to be a sentinel in my community. I'm going to look after my brothers and sisters. I think giving veterans the camaraderie and the continued mission is an important part of keeping us kind of cohesive and in good mental health.
Mm-hmm. Now, not to dig into a more personal side that I prefer. You've mentioned the Sentinel team a couple of times. Can, yes, you explain what that is?
Yeah. So again, you know, our goal with Veterans Adventure League is to provide support to the tables, mm-hmm, which is our table development team, but also provide opportunities for the mental health side of things. So the Sentinel team, originally the goal was just to provide suicide prevention trainings. Mm-hmm. The model we use is VA Save. That's the one I'm trained in. I was providing those every couple of months to new members. We give out like a nice certificate, that kind of thing, just, mm-hmm, so that, you know, anyone that's ever been in the military knows your little certificate of achievement, your little I love me book.
You put it in my love me book, yeah.
You put it in I love me book, right? You know, oh, I got a certificate. This is great. But from there, we also talked about the importance of peer support groups. Mm-hmm. And that is something, obviously, Rebecca, you know, you're highly qualified in. And you've been running that group there for a little bit, trying to gain a little bit more, I guess, not attention for it, but let people know that it exists as a resource mm-hmm. for any listeners that are interested, for example. we've also recently partnered with, there is a, in the Downriver, Michigan area, so we're talking like south of Detroit. Mm-hmm. We've spoken with a gentleman who wants to start a VAL chapter out of like his local American Legion or VFW.
I think VFW.
VFW, that's right, yeah. You're talking about Joe Cotton, yeah. Right, Joe? Hi, Joe, if you're listening. He also has a peer support veteran group. I believe it's called Anchor Vet.
Yep.
I'm like Anchor or Anchor Point. I
think it's Anchor. It's Anchor something.
Anchor something. Yeah. It's a cool name. I wish I remembered it. I'm sorry.
Joe, we will learn your name.
Joe, I swear to God. I'm so sorry. We'll learn it. But yeah, so there's this idea where we very much want to partner with anyone that has any kind of a background in providing peer support, mm-hmm. anyone that's interested in just even having just support groups, right? Where there's a space for veterans to come and talk outside of the table. That can be an essential way, not only for us to support each other, but also to network, to share resources. It drives me crazy how many times people haven't heard about things like 988, for example.
Yeah.
If you're a listener, 988, that is the new National Crisis Hotline. Press 1 to be connected to the Veteran Crisis Line. People still don't know about that, despite mm-hmm. all the advertising that we're doing. And so I think about, okay, these peer support groups, you know, that might not get brought up at a table necessarily, but you know, you play, you jump into the Discord, or you go to the peer support group, and you're talking, and you hear, and you learn more about resources that are available.
Yeah, yeah. And I know that this will air long after, but we are holding a peer support group tomorrow, actually. We're focusing on surviving the holidays.
Yes.
So we are looking to provide that kind of support. So yes,
and that is virtual as well.
So, it is virtual.
There's no barrier. I believe the Anchor Vets. So they're downriver. They I think they meet in person and virtual as well. But the group that you're running right now, the peer support group, that is entirely virtual. Yep. So yeah, that's very easy to get to.
So shifting back to the tables,
yes.
Dustin and I were talking about VAL and what to expect. Dustin has a very loose background in nerd culture.
Yes.
So what is the expectation when joining a table? Do you have, like, what's the experience level? Can you be a new person or do you have to have played before? What can new people expect if they want to join a table?
Ideally, and this is going to sound funny, I remember when I was in basic training and our drill sergeant said that they very often preferred people who had never fired a rifle before in their life to someone that went hunting mm-hmm. because you kind of sometimes had to have them relearn stuff.
Yeah.
Right. In some ways, it can be a real advantage to be a total noob, mm-hmm. to have never in your life even looked at Baldur's Gate 3, let alone sat down and figured out what level your warlock is. Right. Yep. If you're the kind of person where you're like, that sounds kind of silly, it is perfect for you, right? So I would say, you know, there's obviously no skill level required at all. You know, we've got folks who have never played a game before in their life. We have folks like one of the guys at our table, you know, he's been playing since the very first edition came out. You know, he's been playing nonstop since then. And mm-hmm. he could tell you facts about second edition, advanced D&D, why he likes 3.5 more than 5, you know, like, or, you know, 5.5 versus whatever. And the really great thing is that obviously, like, because we're a growing organization, anytime a new person is available, everyone is very excited to see them and mm-hmm. wants to be like, hey, what do you need help with? You know, is there any, do you have any questions? Do you need help setting up your character? The dungeon masters that we have, the folks that are running the tables, are all prepared to accept anyone of any skill level, mm-hmm. right? And I'll give an example. So my dad started playing with us. My father, Persian Gulf veteran, right? He has wanted to play D&D. He played D&D one time when he was a kid and never ever played it again. He's mm-hmm. always wanted to play it, right? My dad has some memory issues, right? He was worried about that. He was like, look, I don't know if I can remember all of my spells and I want to play this cleric, but it's hard for me to remember my feats and my, you know, all of this stuff. No problem, right? It is very easy to make this accessible to anybody mm-hmm. And to make it so that everyone can have a good time. Everyone can have a fun time. Everyone can feel that they're kind of living out that power fantasy, you know yeah. what I mean? Where they're being this cool character that they designed and came up with and they're role playing it without necessarily having to worry about the minutiae of, you know, whatever is on their sheet. And I'll say that's the way it should be for any good table at D&D, yeah. Right? You know, there are some tables where, you know, maybe they might say, hey, at our table, we do expect a certain level of blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. You're not going to find that at Val. You know, our goal really is to just make it as accommodating as possible for everybody. That's the goal. So if you are a total noob, that basically means you have to come play. That's what I just said. You don't have a choice. You have to come play.
There you go. I do want to shout out our DM, Daniel Shinover in Grand Ledge.
Yes, good old Dan.
So Daniel is the one that hosts our biweekly table, and he has been absolutely incredible. So my son, who is 11, wanted to play, and Daniel has been so accommodating, helping him understand the rules, trying to keep things entertaining for an 11-year-old
yes.
who does not have an attention span, and it's already, you know, it's 6:30, 7 o'clock at night after a school day.
Sure, right, yeah. He spent up all his attention credits all throughout the day.
Yes, yeah. But Daniel's been phenomenal about making sure that anyone who sits at the table feels welcome and knows what they're doing. You know, he's had to adjust on the fly a few times to make sure that we didn't have a TPK, that is total yep. party kill for yep. those who do not know, on a bunch of level one characters, including an 11-year-old who has designed his very first Dragonborn. And
oh, heck yeah.
Was
what,
very
what class is he running?
Warlock.
Oh, a Dragonborn Warlock. Nice.
Yeah, he's very excited about it.
Do you know what
it.
Kind of what kind of subclass is he going with? Do you know?
I have not had that discussion with him yet.
Parents, it's never too early to talk to your kids about what Warlock subclass they're going to choose.
Yeah.
Talk to them about the great old ones before or someone else does.
It's probably going to be old ones. He's probably going to be a little scaly boy.
Yeah.
You know, having a pact with big scaly boys.
That's right. That's right.
And Daniel's been phenomenal with it. And on top of that, you know, Daniel's so embedded in the veteran community around here that we will take breaks. And it's immediately we're jumping into, hey, what do you know about this, this, and this in
sure.
the area? So
I'll shout out to Mr. Ian Knapp
yes.
as well, who I had a chance to talk with the other day, who has gone so far as to create a fantastic website for Val, specifically the chapter here at MSU, which
yep.
is fantastic. I had a chance to talk with him the other day, and it's clear it's the same thing, right? There's that real passion for veterans and that real passion for, you know, you're running the game, you're working with your team, and you take your pizza and Doritos break or whatever, your pizza and your Dorito break or whatever it is, mm-hmm. And you say, hey, how's everybody doing? We good? Oh, you're having an issue with your service and pension or whatever, your comp and pen? Are you talking to your VSO?
Mm-hmm.
Here's a card. Here's a phone number, right? That's something that we really encourage folks to do. Whether or not you're the DM, right, that's something that we can all do. There's always that opportunity for us to kind of practice that servant leadership style that we kind of admired in the military.
Yeah.
Absolutely so.
That's one thing that I do want to highlight as well is, so like our table, for example, Daniel worked for the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency. He's been really involved with the Lansing Area Veterans Coalition. He's just very involved in veteran services.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have a veteran navigator, Brandon, who has, you know, veteran himself, and he's very involved in local veteran services as well. And then myself being in vet services for the last 10 years,
right,
trying to get my husband to join the table, who works for Volunteers of America under vet services. You see that at every table, right?
Every single one of them.
Yep.
Yep.
So no matter what table you join, there's always going to be someone there that is going to be able to step aside and say, hey, like as a veteran, what's going on? What can we help you with?
Sure. Yeah. And one great thing too, I think, you know, to kind of expound on that, one of the benefits of, and I think, you know, because I sometimes early on, especially, I'd ask myself, okay, you know, so we're playing D&D, but really what makes this different from just, we're just playing D&D,
yeah.
right? What makes it different? And really it is that ability to network and resource where mm-hmm. if I'm at a table, you know, over in Grayling or whatever, if I'm at a table, you know, the table in Portland, right?
Yeah.
And I got some question. Somebody asked me a question. I don't know. Well, I know that I can talk to Rebecca and Dan, and mm-hmm. they might know, right? I can reach out to them, and you know, we have our monthly meetings the last Tuesday of every month, you know, 7 p.m. If you go on our website, which I'm sure we'll put that up somehow,
yeah.
somewhere. If you go on our website, you can see, you know, it's on our Google Calendar. Anyone can join. we're really encouraging folks to show up because it's a way to find out what's happening around you so you can hear what we're trying to do next and so you can weigh in. You know, we want to hear if it's your very first meeting and you've got something to say, we want to hear from you. Please share your thoughts.
Yeah.
But the ability to network and to problem solve and to have a way to say, hey, yeah, we've got a veteran over here that needs some help. We've helped, like, for example, getting veterans transportation to games. Mm-hmm. That's something that we've worked on. The Ann Arbor Public Library has been a huge benefactor in that regard. We've had folks kind of like lobby them, like, hey, let us use your space, please. You know, mm-hmm. I know it's a little, you know, it's a little bit different from what you're used to, but they've been very open to that. So kind of having folks that can help you and advocate for you and help you network, that kind of thing. That is something that I think helps this organization kind of stand out.
Yeah. So where do you see the Veterans Adventure League headed in the future? What is the ultimate goal?
That's a big question because we're still so new. There's obviously a lot of different ideas about where we could end up. Mm-hmm. You know, there is a sense in which, you know, okay, let's say we become a nonprofit, right? It'd be really cool to be able to get access to grants so we could do stuff like buy people subscriptions to D&D Beyond. Mm-hmm. It'd be really cool to be able to have like a rotating lending library. It'd be really cool if we could have enough money to attend like a Comic-Con or something like that. Mm-hmm. Although I will say I have had some success I kind of sneak into the local Comic-Cons alongside our vet centers, you know. Mm-hmm. I'll go there and I'll kind of pass out the flyers, you know what I mean, that kind of thing. Although I also know it's called, this is out in San Francisco, they just had it, it's called, I think they call it Con, like Genghis Khan.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a board game convention where they specifically wanted veterans to get in for $1. And so they had that and they somehow heard about us and we ended up getting in touch with like a counterpart out in California. We got them our flyers. And so they and according to him, they had a great time. They were okay. Really super veteran, interested in what veterans were doing in the space, that kind mm-hmm. of thing. Passed out a bunch of flyers. So really, you know, if we could, you know, become a nonprofit, you know, that's one avenue we might take. I would personally like to see our peer support services really expand.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the idea of folks not just hearing about the peer support services because they're coming to play D&D, but also the inverse, hear about, oh, you guys play D&D because they're coming to the peer support services, right?
Yep.
That would also be really cool. Really, I think the ultimate goal is to continue providing veterans with a sense of an ongoing mission, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then also continuing to just bring people together and have them have stuff to do. I think it was Ian that proposed the idea of what he called like side quests,
mm-hmm.
which everyone knows side quests can sometimes be, they have nothing to do with the main campaign, but they're a lot of fun, right?
Yep.
So, you know, maybe a side quest is, oh, we all get together and go to the Michigan Renaissance Festival.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on Veterans Day, it's free. Or not Veterans Day, they have a day for veterans where it's free.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing. Or maybe we all get together and they have a bonfire and s'mores or whatever. I don't know. So, yeah, anything that kind of continues to build that bond, I really think that's the general direction we're going to go in.
Awesome. All right. Well, I know that we'll put up the website and everything
yes.
like that,
yep.
but if anyone wants to find more information, where can they look?
So they can go to the website, veteransadventureleague.org. It is still kind of under construction. Like, we're working on coming up with a more interactive map. Mm-hmm. Like, right now, it'll say, you know, the list of a couple of tables that we have, and then it'll say email the admin, which is usually me.
Yeah.
They filter through to me. And we will respond to the emails, and we will let you know where the local table is, but we want it to be so that you can just look on a map and see, I'm here in the Lansing area. I can call Dan, I can call Ian, I can call them, and that kind of thing. So mm-hmm. we're working on that. But you absolutely, if you send us an email through the website, we will respond to it. We also have a Facebook page, which we just got started. My wife has a background in social media. I am finagling her into volunteering her services. See, that's the great thing about this, too, is that, you know, you also have a spouse that you're trying to, like, wrap up into this.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's all very family-oriented.
Hey, service members, veterans, families, you know, it's right there in the acronym. So, yeah, you can absolutely find information there. We do have a Discord that we're trying to get a little bit more movement in. We were just talking about spending more time there. I am a boomer when it comes to Discord. I know that it's like the like millennial app of choice when it comes to this sort of thing, but like I get scared when I see it. So I'm going to have to overcome my fear. My 10-year-old makes fun of me because he already knows how to use it. You know what I mean? He's fine with it.
Yeah.
You know?
We'll hold your hand through it.
Yeah, you're going to have baby steps, right?
Yep.
Baby steps. But yeah, so the website, the Facebook page, if you reach out to us through the website, someone will get in touch with you. Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure having you on and talking about Val today.
Thank you for having me. For all your listeners, thank you so much for your service. Whether you are a veteran, a service member, a family member yourself, thank you. And come roll some dice with us. We would love to have you. Come roll some dice.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Justin.
Thank you. Have a great one.
You've been listening to B2B, Boots to Books.
Thank you for joining us on this journey through the inspiring stories of veterans and military-connected students.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your community.
We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us on social media or take a listen to previous episodes at lccconnect.com or your favorite streaming platform.
Remember, every story is a step forward.
And together, we can build a bridge from boots to books.
Until next time, stay strong.
And keep moving forward.
This has been a presentation of LCC Connect, a weekly program that features the voices, vibes, and vision of Lansing Community College. All shows featured on LCC Connect are recorded at the WLNZ studio, located on LCC's downtown campus. Each program is podcast-based and can be heard anytime at lccconnect.org. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on one of our shows, connect with us by emailing lcc-connect@lcc.edu.